It's good to have your company. You're listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. My name is Simon Smart.
And I'm Natasha Moore.
Now, in 1945, right at the end of the war, Lutheran pastor and theologian Dietrich Bonhoeffer was cynically executed by the Nazis for his role in the plot to assassinate Hitler. He was 39 years old and engaged to be married. His story is known around the world, and Bonhoeffer is a hero of many. It's fair to say both people of faith and those who don't share his beliefs. His courage to act against evil is universally admired. Well, it's also true that plenty of people don't know much more about Bonhoeffer than what I've already told you. But he's now the subject of a play that's currently showing at the Old Fitzroy Theatre in Sydney. It's called Lies, Love and Hitler. And Elizabeth Avery Scott is the playwright and producer, and she's in the studio to talk about it. Good to have you in, Elizabeth.
Hi, Simon. Thank you.
Now, listen, there aren't many plays around that feature theologians. What makes this theologian such an interesting one to write a play about?
Bonhoeffer was a fascinating man of his times. He grew up in quite an upper-middle-class, almost aristocratic family. He was educated, he was a man of culture, a man of letters, and found himself in the middle of Nazism. So watched Nazism descend not only upon his society but also upon his church. And being a clergyman, he found that extremely confronting and was able to see through a lot of the propaganda.
In a way that lots of other people did not.
And so Lutheranism at that time was sort of incorporating Nazi ideology into a lot of their doctrines and into the church. And swastikas went up where crosses used to be and things like this. So I think Bonhoeffer comes to us as a kind of prophet of his time, but also as an educated and intelligent man, someone who we admire and respect in that regard.
Well, if I had the opportunity, I'd try and talk him out of it first.
Ah! Diplomacy with Adolf Hitler. A novel concept. Go on.
It's a non-violent response. Action for the greater good. You rise above accusations of complicity, and he might change his mind.
She's got a point. It's an ethical position.
Yeah, but no guarantees. You might get lucky, or you might get taken out the back and shot. But thanks for playing. Although, if I could choose anyone to talk Hitler out of something, it would be you, Hannah.
But even if you did kill Hitler, there might be somebody else waiting in the wings, and the next man might be just as bad or worse.
So what would you do? If you agreed to kill one tyrant, you'd have to kill them all, yes?
You'd end up with a bloodbath.
Just like the French Revolution. And how does that make you any better than the tyrant you're trying to kill?
But could you stand there and do nothing?
And Elizabeth, you weave the story of Bonhoeffer and his ethical struggle to know what to do about Hitler into a contemporary, ethically complex story of a professor who falls in love with his student. How do you think Bonhoeffer's story speaks into modern ethical dilemmas?
Yeah, well, in the play we see Bonhoeffer's grand history-making schemes and decisions and dilemmas, and I've juxtaposed that with Dr. Langley's sort of personal, intimate story and dilemma. And I think Bonhoeffer did a lot of writing about ethics, how do we make decisions, and very much in the context of, well, here's Hitler, how do we respond to him without talking about Hitler as such by the time he was writing his book on ethics. And so I think, you know, we can look at Bonhoeffer and the things that he wrote about and still apply them today and still look at some of those ideas and apply them to our own lives. And so I've just told a story in the play that applies some of his ethics and his way of thinking about the world.
And one of the big conflicts that comes up in the play is between whether our ethical decisions are really governed by rules, by what's intrinsically the right thing to do, or by results. Does the end justify the means? And the play directly raises that question with the audience of, would you kill Hitler, as emblematic of that tension between rules and results. So, I mean, Elizabeth, I've got to ask, would you kill Hitler?
Would I kill Hitler? I think it's very difficult for those of us who have not lived through a war and have not lived through totalitarianism to know exactly what we might do in that situation. Bonhoeffer was a pacifist and was very against the war and was obviously in favour of peace. And he believed that for two Christian nations to go to war, as Britain and Germany were perceived at that time, was really incomprehensible to him, because it was like one part of the body of Christ attacking or harming another part of the body of Christ. And for him, that was an anathema, and partly why he's a pacifist, of course, also knowing that war is a destructive force to all humanity, no matter what your religious persuasion is. For Bonhoeffer, at first, he would not have killed Hitler. But I think he came to the conclusion that at some point, the only way to solve the problem was to remove the source of the evil, and that was represented by Hitler. So he became embroiled in this conspiracy against Hitler, because some of his friends and family were part of that, and he moved into that circle. So one might say he moved to a position of the ends justifies the means. For myself, I'm not sure that I would do that, but I totally understand why he came to that conclusion at some point.
The contrary, if the church does not call the state to account, who will? This madness has to stop.
I'm a pastor.
I'm a man of God. You tell me. A madman is hurtling down the hall. What should I do? My job is not only to care for those who fall in his past, but also to try and stop him.
And one of the things that Bonhoeffer said, which I think revolutionised the way that I look at the world and some of the things that are going on in the world, he said that sometimes your decision is not between right and wrong as such. It might be between bad and bad, or wrong and wrong, in these very complex situations where there's a lot at stake. You know, I think we often get caught up in some of our first world problems and think that they're ethical challenges as such, but there are much deeper dilemmas out there that people face.
We're speaking with Elizabeth Avery Scott, who is the writer of the play Lies, Love and Hitler. Is there something about the sort of tragic romantic about Bonhoeffer that makes it an enticing thing to write about him as a play?
Yes, I think he has a wonderful story. I mean, a clergyman who effectively became caught up in an assassination attempt, and, you know, became a double agent under those circumstances. So it is a very romantic story, and it's been told and retold in different forms around the world. There's even an opera about him. There's radio plays, and certainly movies and other plays as well. And I think it doesn't lose anything in the retelling. And certainly I've done my own take on that.
It'd be interesting to sort of speculate about what Bonhoeffer himself would make of these sorts of things. He certainly didn't, I imagine, see himself as this hero figure. And there's certain writings of his that reflect that, aren't there?
Yes, I think he would eschew a label like that. I think he probably saw himself as a man in a very difficult situation, but still someone as a man of faith, as a Christian person, trying to do what was right in that situation, standing up for the Jews, speaking against Nazism. But even so, he's often criticised for not going far enough, particularly where the plight of the Jewish people is concerned. Certainly academics, there's a discussion around that, even though he did help a number of Jews to get out of Germany at the time. I think we've got to be very careful about setting him up as some kind of saint, because he was involved in a plot to kill people, or to kill one person in any case.
He very much was about the problem being the suffering of other people, right? That's an important part of the story, isn't it? And he had that famous line about, you know, sometimes we've got to not only bind up the people who are getting crushed under the wheel of this evil regime, but maybe shove a spoke in the wheel to stop it itself. That was, you know, so his motivation was very much for the interest of stopping the suffering of others.
Yes, that's right. And a lot of his writing reflects that as well, that he felt that as a responsible person, he had this idea of the responsible man or the responsible person. We need to take responsibility for those who cannot take responsibility for themselves, or simply as a man of status in society, there are others for whom you must take responsibility.
Do you get the feeling he was a reluctant participant in the kind of everyday stuff? He's such a giant theologically, had an incredible mind, and you get this feeling he's kind of almost reluctantly coming down out of his office to join into this, not just the political struggle, but just the lives of ordinary people.
No, probably probably, I'd say, maybe the opposite to that. I mean, Bonhoeffer, he spent some of his youth or his younger days in America, in New York, and studying at a seminary over there on exchange for a period of time. During that time, he became very aware of the problems facing African Americans at that time, and spent time in Harlem and in a black church where he grew to love Negro spiritual music. He also worked as a pastor in some lower class neighborhoods in Berlin. Worked also in London with German expatriates and refugees. So I think he was connected to people and had a great heart for people, even though when you read a lot of his writings, some of them are very lofty and academic and abstract. But he also had this great heart for people, and he was a pastor, he was a clergyman, a minister, as well as being someone of great intellect.
Elizabeth, one of the things that the main character of the play, Paul Langley, struggles with is that his own moral dilemma compared with Bonhoeffer's seems a bit petty and merely personal. He kind of wants to be this hero, but wonders if modern life is just too mediocre to afford him the opportunity to do that. So he kind of finds himself in this odd position of almost envying Bonhoeffer's horrible circumstances that he faced. Is there still room in the modern world and in our ordinary lives for these kind of grand moral decisions?
I think yes, but I think that in our society today we're very reluctant to go there, because we are, particularly in Australia, you know, a wealthy, prosperous country compared to many, many other places in the world, and a peaceful country. But even so, there are many social issues that we could be doing so much more on and speaking out about. And I wonder, you know, in decades' time, when we look back, will we say, well, we should have spoken up, we should have done more, we should have been more active in speaking up on behalf of people who are suffering, not too far from our shores and indeed at home as well. But I think, you know, we've got ourselves in this situation where wealth and comfort kind of shields us from people who may be suffering. And so we do have minor dilemmas that we face, and of course we have to find our way through those as well and have some mechanism or framework for making those decisions. But certainly there's no end of suffering in the world that we could be doing something about.
It's really interesting part of the Bonhoeffer story is that he was so clear-sighted so early on. There were lots of people who came to understand what was going on and the evil of that, but he seems to be almost alone, in the church at least, as seeing this from, you know, from 1933, he was speaking against this.
Yes.
What do you think made him so clear-sighted, where others maybe understandably weren't as much?
I think part of that was his broad international experience. Like I said, he'd been to New York, and I think that was in sort of 1930, 1931. And so coming back and being able to see the Jewish issue through the eyes of having seen so close, at close hand, the oppression of African American people at that time. I think also he was widely travelled through Europe. He was very engaged in some international church organisations, so met people from all over the world. And so I think that broad experience, plus the fact that he was a man of education and upbringing, you know, a typical Prussian disciplined upbringing. I think, you know, all these things together make him able to see things that perhaps others with more sheltered lives didn't. I think that's why he was able to see early on. And certainly it was something that he discussed with his family, also, you know, educated people. So there's something to be said for that, I think.
One last question. As you think about audiences who come to see your play, what is it you hope that they will leave with?
Well, I hope they'll leave with something to talk about. I hope that they've had a few laughs. The title Lives, Love and Hitler can sound quite heavy, but in fact there's some humorous aspects to it. And I hope they'll go away with something to think about. And really, as a playwright, your job is to raise questions and to tell a story. And I think you'll agree it's a good story that you get out of the night, as well as some things to ponder.
Well, there certainly are those. And I should add that Natasha and I have seen the play and we really recommend others to go and see it. It was a great play. Congratulations on it, Elizabeth. Just mention that again. The play is Lies, Love and Hitler. It's playing at the Old Fitzroy Theatre in Woolloomooloo until May the 3rd. Thanks so much for coming in and talking about it.
Thanks for having me.